You're listening to Brain Busta Radio.
Welcome to Everything Pro Wrestling. Everything Pro Wrestling is a show by the fans, for the fans. And here's your host, Conrad Cushman.
This is Mags from the Badlands Podcast. And when I think of the Graps, I think of Everything Pro Wrestling with Conrad Cushman. Exclusive to Brain Buster Radio.
Happy Saturday, everyone. Welcome to Everything Pro Wrestling. Everything Pro Wrestling is a show by the fans, for the fans. And I'm your host, Conrad Cushman. And we are here to talk about the Great American Bash 1997. Now, as you guys heard in the beginning, when you hear the retro rewind, we are going back in time to review an old pay-per-view. And we are going to WCW, the Great American Bash 1997. Now, it took place on today's date, which is June 15th, 1997. And this was a pay-per-view taking place in Illinois at the Mark of the Quad Cities Arena. The attendance was 19,613. It was a live pay-per-view, and we had on commentary Bobby the Brain Heenan, the American Dream Dusty Rhodes, Tony Schiavone, and we had appearances from Lee Marshall and Mike Tenay. This card up and down looks pretty exciting, and I think that it had a lot to offer us. The show didn't look bad on paper. We had a lot of good things happening, but did it live up to the hype? I guess you guys are here to tune in to find out. So this whole pay-per-view is based on America and everything being the land of the free. The Great American Bash was always a great way to get people to come in. This typically took place in a city like Baltimore or North Carolina. So it was different to see it in Illinois here, but WCW at the time was white hot. They had the NWO going. They had the cruiserweights. Everything was going in their favor at this point, and they were just doing tremendous things. Now, we open up the show with a corny kind of video package talking about Savage Page 2, and it had all of the corny music that you could put with it for the Great American Bash. And I get it. Sometimes it gets a little bit hokey. And you hear Eric Bischoff say that on 83 Weeks, that sometimes these pay-per-views would get a little hokey. And that's just what it was at the time. It's the 90s. Wrestling was still popping. And people really knew what was up with this card. So we open up the show with a match between Psychosis and the Ultimo Dragon. This was called a respect match. So what's been going on? The Ultimo Dragon has been turned on by Sonny Ono. Sonny Ono has enlisted the help of Psychosis, which I'm sure cost him a very pretty penny. And these guys are going to go at it. Psychosis and the Ultimo Dragon, two of the best cruiserweights in that division. It just didn't matter. These guys went in there and they did their thing. The cruiserweights are some of the best in the world during this time. And honestly, it was one of the reasons why I would watch the first hour of Nitro during this time period. The cruiserweights were just fast-paced, good wrestling, and they would do crazy stuff. And to open up this pay-per-view, you would see nothing different. This match ends with the cruiserweights doing all these flips. You saw Ultimo Dragon land a nasty Asai moonsault. That was one of his patented maneuvers. I would say it was probably even his signature move. He lands it so well. And if you guys get the chance to catch Ultimo Dragon before he's like done and retired, I know he's been wrestling in my local area. He also wrestled at House of Glory recently. Ultimo Dragon still really good. So we had high flying, big impact, crazy moves. And this was all about the Ultimo Dragon trying to get his revenge on Sonny Ono. And he made several attempts, but he couldn't get there quite yet. So what happens in this match? Sonny Ono eventually tries to interfere to help his client Psychosis, but he ends up kicking Psychosis in his stomach, and that leads to a Dragon Sleeper tap out. This was a really fun match to me, guys. People were flying all over the ring, And I give it a grade of a B minus. And just when you thought that the Ultimo Dragon was going to get his hands on Sonny Ono, Sonny Ono finds a way to slither away like the snake that he is. And he helps Psychosis out of the ring. Like I said, B minus match. I didn't think it was too bad, but we did what we could. Then we go to a backstage kind of segment here. And they did a lot of these during the 90s on both companies' programs. They had it where Chris Benoit is being interviewed by someone with this big-ass computer for WCW.com. So I guess they're doing like chat room stuff and Chris Benoit's talking. And I'm sure it's the guy typing whatever he says. But really cool to see them starting to get interactive with social media. And look where it's turned out today when you look at how Brainbuster Radio is doing their thing. Social media has a big part in wrestling. And these were kind of the beginning stages of it. So very cool to see. Now, we get to the number one contenders match. We had it was basically number one contenders for the tag team titles. We had Harlem Heat with my girl, Sister Sherry, and they were facing off against the Steiner Brothers. Two of the best tag teams, man, when you go back and think about it. Harlem Heat, very underrated. I love them in WCW. One of the really good tag teams, Booker T and Stevie Ray always held it down. And I think adding Sherry with them really made it good. It was just right. It was like the cream of the crop. I don't know. Sherry being with somebody enhanced the talent. And that's what she did for Harlem Heat. I think she kept them relevant and she still made them one of the top tag teams, even when the NWO was coming in and they could have easily been outshined by other people. But Harlem Heat still were always impressive, and they were always featured on the pay-per-view card because they were that damn good. Now, the Steiner Brothers, you could say the exact same thing for. Legendary tag team. They are kind of a staple of WCW tag team wrestling. Two of the best. And here's something I was thinking about while I was watching this. There are two future world champs in here of Scott Steiner and Booker T. And we would see that a few years down the line, but really cool to just think about that for a second, that Booker T and Scott Steiner would eventually become two of the big dogs for WCW. So we get back into this match. This was a solid, like, hard-hitting contest to where both teams were battling it out. We were seeing some good stuff, and the finish comes when Scott Steiner goes for a Frankensteiner while I don't remember if it was Booker T who was positioned on the top rope. And after he hits the Frankensteiner, it looks like it's all over and people were fighting with the ref. The ref's distracted for a second. And here comes Vincent from the NWO, and Vincent drops the elbow on one of the people in Harlem Heat. I believe it was Booker T. And then we get a disqualification. Unbelievable that we went through that whole match for that. And we get a DQ finish, and Harlem Heat are announced as the number one contenders because Vincent interfered. Well, that didn't go over well with the Steiner Brothers. The babyfaces get angry, and they decide that they're going to whip some butt. They grab Vincent, and they end up clotheslining him, knocking him down. They rip his shirt off, and they set him up for like a doomsday bulldog, and they plant him. And basically, nobody from the NWO came out to help Vincent. That was odd to me, number one. It just seems very, very strange that happened the way it did. I've got nothing here. I mean, that's what it was. Harlem Heat's the number one contenders. They have earned themselves a tag team title shot, and the Steiner Brothers put a beat down on Vincent. So we'll have to wait and see where this continues. Now, our next match. Oh, man. I'm sorry, guys. This match is stinker of the night to me, in my opinion. This match was god-awful for this show. And I don't know. I feel like it was just these two opponents didn't click and something wasn't right this night between them. So Conan turned on Hugh Morris after they lost to the Steiner Brothers at the previous month's pay-per-view. So these guys have been kind of like teasing a feud, and this is where it all is going to happen. So during this match, we have Conan versus Hugh Morris. Not a fun match. Very awkward spots, boring, and stuff just did not mesh well. It's hard to watch at some points. Conan even has like a stump puller locked in at one point on Hugh Morris, and Conan just lets it go because he's like, this looks like crap, and Hugh Morris ends up just getting put into kind of like a different wear down submission hold. I don't know. It was just bad. Bad. So hopefully we don't see any more bookings like this in the future. Conan ends up getting the win with the Tequila Sunrise, and you couldn't tell these guys to get out of there quick enough, and I think they knew it was a stinker. I give that a grade of a D+, and I'm sorry, the Steiner Brothers and Harlem Heat match I gave a C+, if I didn't mention that. So Harlem Heat, Steiner Brothers, C+, Conan, Hugh Morris, D+. Next, we have Public Enemy come out. Public Enemy comes out with the table, and you know, they're doing the wave your hands from side to side. Looking back at this when I was watching it on the network, dude, this was so corny. I liked Public Enemy, though, back then. I think it was because they brought tables to the ring and they were bringing something different that most people weren't doing back then because of their extreme style, I guess you would call it, or they would use Rocco Rock to flip over on the table. But Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge were out there. They were kind of like the hot new tag team in WCW. And Mean Gene Okerlund is talking about the hotline. Here comes Public Enemy. And they start talking about partying and everything else. And Mean Gene Okerlund was just trying to get his whole who's coming to the company. And we don't know who it is at the time, but he was trying to get that hotline money. Public Enemy comes out there. They sit out there and they go into the crowd. They party with the people. And it's weird to see them like high-fiving kids if you know their ECW history. But Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge did their thing. And you know what? They had to make the best of their situation. They were trying to get paid. They were trying to get some money. Johnny Grunge and Flyboy Rocco Rock, they did their thing here. It was not great in the end, but it was Public Enemy, dude. They were just known for putting people through tables. They're not the greatest of wrestlers. Paul Heyman figured out a way to make these guys get over with the people, even though they weren't great wrestlers. And WCW was kind of trying to leech off of that a little bit here. And it didn't work for me. Wasn't the best thing. We get to the fourth match on this card. We had Wrath with James Vanderberg, a.k.a. James Mitchell, versus Glacier. And Mortis was going to be handcuffed to the turnbuckle. Not going to lie, this was probably one of the better matches for Wrath. Singles-wise, this match is not great. I am not the biggest fan of this whole feud, and you know the Mortal Kombat characters that Glacier was, quote-unquote, Sub-Zero. We just saw Glacier at an AEW event, and he spit mist in someone's face, and they were frozen. I mean, it's funny now, but back then, you were just like, oh, brother, what is this? Mortis looks like one of the people from Mortal Kombat. Wrath, I mean, it was cool for what they were trying to do, but they kept these guys lumped in together. And at the time, Glacier was undefeated. So Glacier was on a big undefeated streak. Does it end here? So the match goes on, and it's a little clunky, but they're trying to do these martial arts style moves, and I get it. It's difficult to land martial arts style moves when you can't really kick somebody. It's hard to pull back a kick when you're a trained martial artist, is what I'm trying to say. And Eric Bischoff has said this multiple times on 83 Weeks, and I completely understand what he's talking about. But when you look back at this match, the key point in it was basically what was happening during it. So Mortis is handcuffed, like we said, to the outside. James Vanderberg ends up getting on the apron to distract the ref, asking him for the key because Mortis' hand hurts because Glacier knocked him off the rope, whatever the situation is. He's distracting the ref. Mortis gets a chain out to throw, and he clearly overthrows it. Like, this is like a bad elementary school basketball pass. Overthrows it. Glacier ends up finding the chain, wrapping it around his hand, clocking Wrath with it. He gets the 1-2-3, and you knew what happened after the match. Glacier ended up getting the beat down. They brought the handcuffs in, and they started beating him down. After this match was over, it was all right. I mean, nobody was like, oh, Glacier won. It was just kind of like, okay, it's over. Cool. Not a big deal. C- for that match, and that's good, like I said, for that time period, because a lot of these matches were rough a little bit, I'll say. Not the greatest, but I still think they did some solid work. And I know people are like, oh, but you gave it a C-. C-minus is not bad. It's teetering on almost bad, but I think this was much better than the stuff they've been given that you guys will see later on if you go and watch future WCW pay-per-views. And by the way, I did end up reviewing some of these other shows. I think I did a long kind of tribute on my Everything Pro Wrestling podcast where I started reviewing stuff from 1997 Hog Wild all the way till we get to Starrcade 97. So I put some stuff out there for people to check out. So if you guys want to get my thoughts on some of the other matches on the shows, check those out. We get to the next match. We have title versus career. And in this match, the WCW women's title is on the line. And it's easy to forget that they even had a WCW women's title for how it was treated. But we had Akira Hokuto versus Medusa. Now, Hokuto actually has a really kind of dope entrance attire with the sweet mask that she comes out with. I really liked it. I thought it was dope. I don't know. Ever since I saw that match as a kid and I saw her perform, she wasn't bad. She did. The entrance was just dope to me. Absolutely loved it. The design of the WCW women's belt looked kind of cool, too. I didn't mind it. I thought it looked kind of like throwback, but still had enough on it. So we get the dope entrance for this. Medusa comes out. She's rocking the red, white, and blue. Very patriotic. It fits the theme of the pay-per-view. Medusa comes out here and does her thing. And when we get into this, Medusa is really focusing on trying to win this title. And going back and thinking about what was happening at the time, I truly believe that Medusa was going to win this match. So she put her career on the line, career versus title. And she ends up in the match hurting her leg. Now, the leg is being worked on throughout the entire match. There's even some comical parts, if you really look at it, to where she starts working on the wrong leg. And Medusa's trying to put, like, the left leg on the rope, like, get this one. And you can even see Sonny Ono, like, this leg. One of the better things of having managers out there. So Sonny Ono is telling Akira to focus on that leg. She goes to work, and in this match, she is putting the pain on. Medusa has a great comeback sequence here with a power bomb, even a German suplex where Sonny Ono grabs her leg to pull her out. And they do some really good stuff here, but in the end, Akira ends up hitting like a snowplow kind of move. If you remember Al Snow's snowplow, she does that kind of driver on her, and 1, 2, 3. Medusa's career is over. That was something that you did not expect. Akira Hokuto ends up defeating Medusa, and I couldn't believe it at the time either. I was just like, what? She's not going to be the WCW Women's Champion ever? Like, what's the deal with this? And after the match, Mean Gene. Mean Gene. So Mean Gene Okerlund comes up to Medusa and he starts like bothering her, basically like, your career is over. What are you going to do? And, you know, like Medusa's being helped to the back because her left knee is injured and she's kind of like blowing him off like, all right, that's enough of this. And people are like yelling like, leave her alone, leave her alone. But Mean Gene Okerlund always knew how to stir the pot here. So I didn't take any offense to what Mean Gene was doing. I just found it very interesting what was happening at the time. Once again, I give this a grade of a C. I don't think it was bad. I thought it was solid work in that ring. A little bit better than the Glacier and Wrath match, of course, but you had two different talents in here working, and I just thought they did a good job with it, and I was shocked by the ending of the match. I could not believe that they were trying to say Medusa's career was over, but to me, at this point in the show, I really felt like not a lot of stuff was bad after this. So this is kind of the, all right, let's get it into second gear to finish off this show. And I thought they did a really good job with that. Now, before we get into the second half of the show and we take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, I do want to give a shout out to a few people. Number one, shout out to XGW Fed on Twitter. I appreciate my XGW family. Appreciate you guys always giving me retweets, likes, sending me love. I can't ask for anything more from you guys on social media. So thank you guys for that. Also, quick shout out to Clark Street Wrestling. I know they're on Anchor. those guys reached out to me today, just talking about some pro wrestling stuff. Thought it was really cool. So I decided to give them a shout out here on Brainbuster Radio. And a big shout out to my man, Mags, who let us into the show. Mags, I appreciate you. And you know what? Your Badlands introduction on this show, it actually fits the theme perfectly. And I couldn't ask for anything more that was American made. So Mags, thank you. Make sure you guys check out Badlands every Thursday on Brainbuster Radio. Mags does a tremendous job with his Mount Rushmores along with Paul. And you guys do not want to miss a single episode of their show. But with that being said, we're going to get into an advertising break. And then we're going to come right back and talk about the second half of this show where stuff starts to really pick up for me. So make sure you guys keep it locked in with Brain Buster Radio.
Hey, everyone. David Conrad here, owner of the Gorilla Position Wrestle Store. We're an online store headquartered in San Antonio, Texas, bringing you the best and original wrestling shirts, accessories, collectibles, and more. We're glad to be partnering with Brainbuster Radio, and to thank them and to thank you, we're offering 10% off all purchases with the coupon code BRAINBUSTA. That's BRAINBUSTA. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under @GPWrestleStore. Or check out our website, www.gpwrestlestore.com. Remember, when you want the best wrestling experience, you gotta hang out in Gorilla Position.
Hey everybody, this is Tanner.
And this is Steven.
From Headlock Talk.
And you're listening to Everything Pro Wrestling Podcast
on Brain Buster Radio.
Big shout out to my boys, Headlock Talk. You can catch them every Tuesday on Brain Buster Radio. So thank you guys for that. Now, before we get back into this card, I want you guys to also make sure you guys are following Brainbuster Radio on Twitter @Brainbuster Radio. And also make sure you guys check out our link tree. It's in the description of this podcast and also on the Twitter page. You guys got to follow our Brainbuster TV on Twitch. We're going to be using that for some big things in the future. So make sure you guys are following us on all social media platforms. Let's get back into this card, though, shall we? We start with a return death match for the next one. These names just sound really cool for it, but it really didn't mean anything to me back then even. Two of my favorites, though, from WCW at the time. We have the Canadian Crippler, Chris Benoit, taking on Ming with Jimmy Hart. Two of my favorites. If anybody knows me from way back in the day, you will know that I would be one of the first people to put you in the crossface or lock in the Tongan death grip. One of my favorite moves. Ming never gets enough credit for that. Just a good thing, man. So Ming comes out second to make his entrance in this match. And this is all stemming from what was going on before with the Horsemen and guys from the Dungeon of Doom. And Chris Benoit does a suicide dive that it looked like him and Ming's heads connected so hard. And that was a suicide dive. Not the stuff we see today where it looks all soft sometimes. They crashed into each other, these guys. So everything is happening during this match, and Jimmy Hart gets scared. Now, why is that? Because Woman is now retired, and Chris Benoit went up against Ming in a return death match in a sequel to their previous outing at Slamboree. So these guys were going at it in this match. So this meant that there is no DQ, whatever. It's kind of like you're fighting to the death, is how they tried to put it. It didn't really work that way for WCW. They had horrible stipulations sometimes when it comes to this stuff. They were trying to explain it, but it really wasn't working for me. So these guys are fighting in this match. It's brutal. You're seeing chops, kicks. Basically, these two just beat the crap out of each other. There's no other way to put it. Like, hard-hitting action, they're not messing around. These guys were very impressive in this match. And why was it impressive? It's because it feels like a fight. All the stuff that happened with Woman and Kevin Sullivan and all of that. And if you guys don't know about that, we'll save that for another podcast. But all of that fuming behind this, and it just felt right. You know, like, it just felt like it was going to be a fight to the finish. And these are two of the toughest hombres in WCW at the time. So this match goes through all the fighting feels, and then Chris Benoit keeps trying to lock in the crossface for the victory here. He goes for it several times, taking Ming down from his left arm. And eventually Ming is put into the crossface and Benoit is wrenching on it. And this is the longest they said anybody has ever lasted in the crossface. Ming is sitting there, and after the third attempt to lock it back on, he's sitting there holding it on Ming. Ming is fighting it, not tapping out, but he is starting to fade. And eventually Ming does the kind of slow tap out. It's not as good as Triple H WrestleMania 20, but I think it got across the point that it was trying to, that Ming is a tough dude and he did not want to tap out. I think they could have done this a little bit better if they did the whole Bret Hart, Steve Austin ending. Maybe Ming didn't have to tap out. He could have just passed out. And I think you would have got him over more as a tough guy. And I think it would have added a little bit more to the match, but they still got their point across with it nonetheless. So after the match, Benoit lays out and he's down. Ming's laid out and down. Ming doesn't move. And I give Ming all the credit in the world because he looked like he was legit injured from it and passed out. And Chris Benoit gets put into a neck brace and he gets wheeled off on a stretcher, basically. And they also come back and they bring a stretcher out for Ming. And Ming eventually gets put onto the stretcher. And somehow during the transition of Ming getting up the stage, he falls off the stretcher. And Mean Gene Okerlund was just talking about it while he was on the microphone, basically once again going to the hotline before we get into our next match again. And it got Ming over. Like I said, I enjoyed this match. It fit my personal taste. I gave it a B. And maybe someone's going to say I'm overrating it. I don't care. I enjoyed this match, so I gave it a B. We also get an advertisement here for Bash at the Beach. They are teasing this. Now, I want you guys to understand how big this was at the time. Hollywood Hulk Hogan in the NWO, it'll be like the one-year anniversary or the one-year to the date or pay-per-view, I guess we should say, of the NWO starting. Hogan will be there and his tag partner, Dennis Rodman, to take on Lex Luger and the Giant. None of these guys were in the building for this event, and I really felt like they were letting other guys kind of shine here because the NWO was everywhere and they were taking over. And we'll get into that because the NWO is in the two main events, kind of the double main event of this show. But they went out there, and Dennis Rodman. Now think, it's 1997. The Bulls are one of the hottest teams in the NBA, and Dennis Rodman is here with the NWO. This man had action figures. I had the action figure of Dennis Rodman with the green hair, with the NWO shirt on, with the sunglasses and everything. He was a big deal. I don't know if people really don't understand that. Like, they just beat the Utah Jazz. Jordan hit that beautiful push-off shot where he made it. I don't care. It was beautiful. And the Bulls were one of the best teams around at the time. Everybody that played on that team had big name value, and Dennis Rodman was one of them. So kudos to WCW for being able to get him. Shout out to Lex Luger, who was back with the company for a few years, but Luger remained in a top spot. And the Giant, one of the people who they needed to be pushing at the time. Cool stuff here. We get to our next match. We have Steve Mongo McMichael with Queen Deborah versus Kevin Green. Mongo seems like he's been interested in wrestling since WrestleMania 11. If you guys can find him, that's kind of a cool thing. Mongo is out here doing his thing. He is a former Chicago Bear, so they're in Illinois. I thought Mongo would get a better response, but the Chicago wrestling fans know. Like, I'm sure they all travel to this event. They know, like, we're not cheering Mongo McMichael. And then we had Kevin Green, who at the time was a Carolina Panther. I remember the Panthers being one of my favorite teams during this time. Very, very cool to see that Kevin Green came out, and I thought he did tremendous for someone who really isn't involved in wrestling. Kevin Green went out there. He wrestled this match. He had some nice transitions. He moved well in the ring, and he's an athlete, so I get it. But I thought Kevin Green did really good for what he could. I liked it. And we would see him a couple times in WCW. So Kevin Green, awesome work. I really liked it. And it was another use of a star or a celebrity in WCW while they were rising to the top. So good job by WCW once again. So let's get to the finish of this match because it was okay. You get to Deborah distracting the referee. Randy Anderson is over there jawjacking with her. And Jeff Jarrett comes out with a briefcase. And it looks just like Mongo's briefcase. And Kevin Green pulls Mongo in and Mongo gets the briefcase across the back of the head. He's knocked out. Kevin Green gets the pin. 1, 2, 3. I gave it a grade of a C. Jarrett screwed up. And this was kind of the big feud between Mongo and Jarrett and what was going to happen and the Four Horsemen. Lots of drama. Yada, yada, yada. Kevin Green got the win here. And you guys would have to continue watching Nitro to see how this story unfolds. And I'm not going to ruin it for you at this point. But there's still more to this story. We then go backstage where we see Medusa, who is still crying, and she is in pain with her knee, and it's being checked over by one of the trainers in the back. Tony Schiavone told us that it was serious, then Medusa wouldn't be able to compete for months. But then Tony Schiavone remembered, like, oh, yeah, she can't because she lost her career. So they tried to do it, but I think the storyline plan here was that Medusa was going to eventually find a way to return and capture the WCW women's title. But unfortunately, that never got to happen. We get to a big tag team championship match here. We had the WCW World Tag Team titles on the line. We had Hall and Nash being accompanied to the ring by Six, who was the current Cruiserweight champion. These guys were draped in gold versus the Nature Boy Ric Flair and Rowdy Piper. Now, can I just say this? I love the charisma in this match from everybody involved. Six, a ball of fire. We also have Hall and Nash, two of the coolest guys in the room. They were able to go out there. They had their swag the entire time. Ric Flair got this crowd riled up from his entrance when he started giving out the chops and, you know, going crazy, doing the thrust and everything. Ric Flair looked like you're playing WCW NWO Revenge. You're just like, dude, what is wrong with this dude? But Ric Flair was the man. So Piper's out there. Piper just knew how to get people on fire too, just by him yelling and fighting back. So this was a fun match. What winds up happening is they show Hall and Nash dominate, but once Flair and Piper started using some of their dirty tricks, because they are two of the best heels of all time, Ric Flair and Rowdy Piper were able to use low blows and everything else to get back into this match. The problem is Piper gets into the ring and he starts getting into trouble. Before Ric Flair can even save him, Six interferes and Flair's not going for it. Flair chases Six down. He chops him. The arena erupts for it. Just go back and watch it. The moment he lands that chop, the fans go crazy. Ric Flair beats Six all the way up the ramp with punches, chops, whatever, and he chases him all the way to the backstage area. This leaves Piper by himself with the outsiders. Piper has to fight off Hall and Nash. He is fending for himself during this time period. He makes a few heroic runs, but in the end, the outsiders' edge became too much for them. 1, 2, 3, Hall and Nash get the victory in that one. They start saying that it was for Hollywood. They throw up the 2 sweet, and nobody knows where Six and Ric Flair went. Piper looks sad, and he ends up getting carried out by the referee. Very crazy for what happened in this. I gave this a grade of a B-. I didn't think they did too bad in this one. This one really impressed me, actually. I love the charisma. I love the energy in it, and I thought it was fun. It was built off of the personalities and not the wrestling in the ring. So lots of good stuff here. And that's one of the beautiful things about wrestling. Now, before we get into the main event, I just had a reflection moment when I was thinking about this too. Think about this. A year ago before this, Hall and Nash powerbombed Bischoff at the Great American Bash 1996 onto a table. A year later, the NWO is the hottest thing in pro wrestling. Eric Bischoff is with the NWO, and things have just changed so much in a year. And I just wanted to bring that up so people could just put things into perspective. The NWO were over. Those t-shirts were everywhere. Those shirts and Stone Cold Steve Austin shirts, you would see them in an airport walking down the street, going to get a burger from McDonald's. People had these shirts on. We get to the main event. Now, during this time period, WCW was trying to show that they could do it big just like everybody else. So they had Michael Buffer doing the ring announcing. He does this whole, let's get ready to rumble. They had all the bells and whistles with Michael Buffer. The lights went out. They had the fireworks. Everything was happening. The pyro was good. And we have the match between Macho Man Randy Savage with Miss Elizabeth versus Diamond Dallas Page with Kimberly. Now, this was called a lights out match or a false count anywhere match, whatever you want to call it. Once again, the names of these horrible and it didn't matter. These guys were going to have a fight. And just like Chris Benoit and Ming, their fight was more contained in the ring. This one was a serious brawl. Now, they had a no DQ match at Spring Stampede, but these guys were going at it. But to me, this is one of their best matches here. Savage was going insane. He reminded me of the old Macho Man Randy Savage, showing he could still go. And he just did his thing. He took out referees, photographers. He almost took out Kimberly. DDP's moving Miss Elizabeth. People are getting slammed through picnic tables. They even had the Weber grill out. And the Weber grill, the charcoal was getting tossed on Macho Man. It was just crazy. Savage is bleeding from his arm. These guys really did a lot to make sure that you believed that anything could happen in this match. Really good stuff here. At one point, DDP hits a diamond cutter and you think it's over, but all the referees are down. And here comes Scott Hall. He tries to hit DDP with his tag title. DDP ducks. He puts them hands on Scott Hall and Macho Man ends up clobbering DDP with the belt. The numbers were too much. Where is everybody else when I'm saying stuff like this is what I'm wondering. Where's Luger? Where's Giant? Where are all these other people? But Scott Hall ends up hitting the outsider's edge once again on DDP, and Macho Man Randy Savage goes up to the top rope, drops an elbow, 1, 2, 3. Right after this match is over, it felt very odd. I don't know if there were time constraints at this point because the announcers really quickly kind of ended this. They were like, all right, thank you, everybody. This has been the Great American Bash. And they like kind of sent it off. And I'm like, wow, that was quick. We're not going to get highlights. We're not going to talk about any of this. But we got nothing at that point. Not mad at it. If they had time constraints back then, they had time constraints. I really wish that we had the proper music for like DDP, though, when you're watching this match, because you know nobody would have been hyped for that song that they have on the WWE Network. Ugh, just terrible. But I get it. You can't use the rights because of Nirvana and everything else. But grade for that match, A-. That's going to be one of the highest grades you ever hear me give like a WCW match. I thought they did really good here. It was DDP's kind of like blossoming party. DDP really showed that he could be a main event player here. And this was good that Hogan and the NWO weren't heavily featured on this show. It allowed guys like DDP and Macho Man to show what they could bring to the table. And they showed that they were still players in my eyes. And I thought they did very well. Overall show grade. I feel like I could possibly give it a higher score, but for right now, what I was feeling after watching it was a B-. Solid show, really good, nothing to complain about. And 97 to me is the best year for WCW. They just came in, they had their good matches, and they did their thing. Once in a while, you get some hokey booking in there, but for the most part, WCW was solid in 1997, and I can always go back and watch some of their shows from this time period. Because they were clicking on all cylinders and they had the NWO, the hottest thing going on, and some of the best WCW superstars with Sting, Luger, the Giant, DDP, the names could go on and on. Flair, the Horseman, good stuff. Just overall good stuff here. But I have all my ratings in the description box, guys. I want to know, what did you think of the Great American Bash 1997? Why don't you guys give it a watch? And tell me what you thought of the show. What were your grades? Did you agree, disagree? You guys can find me on Twitter at EPW Show to tell me your thoughts. And with that being said, I want to thank you guys so much for listening to Brainbuster Radio. Don't forget to tune back in tomorrow when my friends Wrestle Thoughts will be on Brainbuster Radio. Make sure you guys check them out. I'm out. Peace.